It's time for Sports Lit 101. Bruce Pratt with us in studio. And we're joined on the telephone line by a friend of the program, back with us to talk about the centennial edition of this terrific history of the National Football League. Dick Crapo joins us. Dick, thank you so much for being with us.
Hey, Rich. Good to be on. And I've been listening to your weather report. And if you could send some of that cool air down here to Florida, I'd be quite pleased. It hit close to 90 today. So.
Well, you know what? We'll make a trade, but perhaps we could combine the two so we could both get...
Yeah, I was thinking combining might be best.
Right. Something in the 70s for both of us would be just lovely. Right.
Oh, you guys.
So, Dick, since the original...
Hey, Bruce, how you doing?
Well, I'm doing well, Dick. Good to hear your voice.
Dick, since the book first came out, has anything happened to change the National Football League's stranglehold on that title of national pastime?
No. No, I don't think so. And it would seem to me to be a long time before that's going to change. And I have no idea really what might change it.
You know, Dick, you mentioned, and I was looking at Chapter 11 again last night, Goodell, you know, actually told his father he wanted to become the commissioner of the NFL. That was one of his goals, one of his dreams. He was clearly connected. His dad was a well-known politician in New York State. How much do you think his understanding of PR from a political point of view has helped him shape and bond the NFL?
You know, he says about his own sort of view of things that he got his MBA not in a university, but that he got it by working with Roselle and Tagliabue. And I think that's really where his whatever insights he has really come from there. I'm not sure how much of the political from his father really comes over. His father, I don't know if you know this, but his father was one of the early opponents of the Vietnam War and took a lot of flack for that. And so I'm not sure whether what kind of impact they may have had on him. But, you know, his own view is that his education and particularly his PR education came from Pete Roselle and to a lesser degree, I think, Paul Tagliabue.
So for a guy who has that background, how did he do such a, I would say, poor job of handling first the Colin Kaepernick situation and then the whole issue of kneeling for the anthem?
Well, yeah, that's a great question. And it's one that certainly I asked myself over and over again. I guess my first sort of flip answer would be, well, maybe he didn't learn much at the school of Roselle and Tagliabue. Maybe he only thought he learned stuff because he did not handle most things very well. And I think his public relations skills are really quite limited. Now, that may be a function of his the awkwardness of his personality. He is really kind of a wooden character. And if you watch him much, you get a really good sense of that. And that might be part of it. I think the other part of it is I think he's very, I think he's somewhat insecure in his position. He probably more than any of these of his predecessors understands that he's there at the behest of the owners. And at any moment they could say goodbye. So that maybe makes him cautious, but he has been incredibly inconsistent in his treatment of most every issue. And you think, well, he goes through one thing and he's going to have learned something, and then something similar comes up and apparently he learns nothing. So it's a bit of a mystery, I think.
Would you say that the owners today, who are different, I think, from the Rooneys and the Bert Bells and the others,
so.
Are interested, number one, in labor peace?
No, they're interested, number one, in bottom line. And I think labor peace is maybe a sort of a secondary function of that. But bottom line is their issue. And he's been very, very good, extremely good about he's been very, very good. I just got a call on my phone, which I got rid of. He's been very, very good on bottom line. And I think that's that's what the connection is for them, and what the attraction is for them. Labor peace is nice, but they still think that it's important that they're running the NFL, and that the players are not running the NFL. And that line for them is one that you don't cross.
Yeah, one of the people who's on the show a lot is Upton Bell, and he has talked about the same thing before, about the lack of football people in the business end of football.
Yes.
And I was wondering if you could sort of expand, because I know I've heard you talk about that before in person, if you could just sort of lay out how that's all happened.
Well, the founding generation, these were all basically football people. And what has happened is that the founding generation has aged, as we all have, and they've been replaced by people who've inherited teams, or who inherited teams and then sold them off. And the corporations have become much more interested in getting into this business. And so over time, with the death of the founders, the personnel at the top has changed, and changed considerably.
We're talking with Dick Crapo here on Downtown. I've always been a fan of Bob Costas and his work, but I even more respect in reading your chapter on the response of the National Football League to the concussion issue, and on Costas,
man, yes,
and his willingness to sacrifice a pretty high profile and I'm sure well-paying position for what he felt was the right thing to do.
Yeah, I think that's a really impressive story from several standpoints. And I think the one that you just pointed out, that clearly Bob Costas was a man of principle on this, and he thought that that they were fumbling the concussion issue, and that the concussion and its connection to brain damage and CTE and these other things was something that was real and that needed to be addressed. And when he did that one too many times, essentially he was told, or NBC, I should say, was told that Bob Costas should not be involved in Super Bowl broadcasting anymore, or in fact any NFL broadcasting anymore, because he simply was at odds with the basic message of the National Football League on the concussion issue. So I agree with that. Very, very impressive. And of course, it also tells you something about the NFL's basic approach to the concussion issue, which essentially they approach it as a public relations issue, not as a health issue. And they've always taken that position. That's as old as the issue itself, is that, and that particular approach to the issue by the league. And the Costas issue is one of those. I think the other one that illustrates this really very, very profoundly, and in some ways very sadly, was the Hall of Fame induction of Junior Seau, where Seau's daughter had been given by her father a statement that he wanted read if he was ever inducted, and the NFL would not allow her to speak at the induction ceremony. She called a press conference herself, or contacted press people herself, invited them to her hotel, and she read the statement there. But the NFL would not allow her to take any kind of a speaking part in the induction ceremony. Again, PR over reality.
Well, and I think it's that response to the CTE issue that led me to be not at all surprised at their approach to handling the pandemic.
Yeah, I'm still trying to figure out what exactly is their approach to handling the pandemic, other than doing their best to ignore it. I don't remember who said this first, but I think it says it all, is that the NFL thinks it's more powerful than any other thing or institution, or in this case, disease in the world, and that COVID-19 is no match for the National Football League. Well, they may find out that that's not quite the case.
I've been a little surprised that there haven't been more anger for, well, maybe anger is the wrong word, but it has been more sort of protest from coaches and maybe some GMs and the like, or, and more players about playing under these conditions. Does any of that surprise you, or am I just thinking more people should be altruistic?
No, it really doesn't surprise me all that much. You know, I think there are a number of players who are probably uncomfortable, but they know that they're already playing under conditions that are hazardous to their health, and that's been quite apparent since the concussion issue has surfaced. And so I think they may well look at this as just another problem. I think coaches, on the other hand, particularly the older coaches, have a lot of misgivings about potential exposure to COVID-19. Those of us of an advanced age are perhaps a bit more cautious about COVID-19 than others, and I think that some of the coaches are in that position. But you know, in the overall approach, I don't think anything really surprises me in that area.
When we think about the Super Bowl, as you pointed out, there's almost no way to think of it as being anything but excessive. has the NFL figured out something other networks? I mean, other sports haven't figured out about the more over the top, the more they grow.
I think the National Football League is in a very, very distinctive place in regard to the other professional sports. It dominates its season, and it dominates the networks during its season. It is the only game in town when it's going on, and maybe the only game in town now almost year round. The more they can celebrate and the more they can create a sense of national celebration around themselves, I think the better off they think they are. And at every step of the way, every change in technology, the coming of the iPhone and the apps and the tremendous growth of social media, all of these things have played right into that sense of excess. I mean, what's more excessive than social media? Hard to find anything else. And they've exploited that so well.
Well, Dick, I really want to thank you for being on with us today. And I want to remind people that your book is NFL Football, A History of America's New National Pastime. It's from the University of Illinois. The Centennial Edition has new information in it and brings us up to date.
And I say one thing. Can I say one
other
thing about that?
Sure, please do.
I did page proofs right at the end of February, and so nothing new could go in after the end of February. And so it seems to me that in the last 6 months now, it's time for another edition, given the remarkable sort of developments that have taken place over the last 6 months.
Well, if they'll put it out, we'll talk to you about it again. And I thank you again.
Thank you so very much
for being with us today, Dick. Best to Pat.
Okay, thanks very much. Yeah, best to you too. Bye-bye.
Thank you, Dick. Dick Rapoport with us on Downtown Sports Lit 101 at 4:47. And what's ahead for next week on Sports Lit?
Well, this is a remarkable book. This book is written by someone who's been on the show twice, David Davis. His book, Waterman, and we talked about his book called Showdown at Shepherd's Bush. This is Wheels of Courage. This is about we'll use different terms, but how paralyzed veterans from World War II began to have wheelchair sports and paraplegic sports. This is a story I did not know. Most of us do not know. I'd be surprised if anybody knows the depth of it. And David will be on with us in a couple of weeks. We're not sure yet, but it's called Wheels of Courage. It's a really remarkable book, and it is from Center Street Books.
Excellent. We'll look forward to that.